Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, where you hear about the business of the casino entertainment industry from the people who make it happen. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we feature an interview with Kate Lowenhart-Fisher, a member of the gaming and hospitality practice group of the Dickinson Wright Law Firm, on how sports betting could play out following a Supreme Court decision. The GGB podcast is brought to you by the Southern Gaming Summit, the most important regional conference in the casino industry. The Southern Gaming Summit will be held on May 2nd and 3rd of this year and will feature keynote speeches from Jeff Freeman of the American Gaming Association and Chief Phyllis Anderson from the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. For more information on attending or sponsoring SGS, visit sgsummit.com. The upcoming Supreme Court decision in a case brought by the state of New Jersey is bound to have an impact on the legality of sports betting in the U.S. Kate Lowenhart-Fisher, a member of the Gaming and Hospitality Practice Group of Dickinson Wright, is working with clients to understand how the nuances of any decision rendered by the court will affect the individual states. As a Nevada attorney, Lowenhart-Fisher believes other states should just emulate the successful Nevada regulations and processes, but understands it is not likely to happen. She discusses the options and how companies with sports betting expertise outside of the U.S. can capitalize on legalization. She spoke with me in the Dickinson Wright offices in Las Vegas in February. Look at me. Kate Lowenhart-Fisher, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. It's good to see you. We saw each other in London a week ago, so we're both recovering a little bit, but thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about sports betting in this interview. This has become an area of expertise for your firm and you in particular. So let's start with you know, we've got this upcoming Supreme Court decision looming over us, probably in the spring, they're supposed to say something?
I think May is probably a good prediction.
Great. So is this going to make or break the legalization effort? If it goes against the New Jersey, is that going to, are we back to square one? Or what do you come down on that?
No. I think that the decision on the PASPA case in Christie 2, if we're still allowed to call it Christie 2.
Yes, Christie
2. Now that he's no longer governor. Yeah. It's not a make it or break it day. Mm-hmm. I think that what has become clear is that the attitude in the United States towards sports betting has completely changed over the past 25 years. And I think that no matter what the decision is of the Supreme Court, I think that momentum will lead to some fundamental changes when it comes to sports betting in the United States, no matter what.
Yeah. Well, you know, PASPA is clearly a failed law. I mean, it was supposed to prevent illegal sports betting, and it's actually encouraged it. So you think Congress will address this issue no matter what happens with that decision?
I think so. And, you know, what's pretty funny is that this is probably a real bipartisan issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a lot of friends on both sides of the aisle when it comes to if not legalizing sports betting, at least repealing those federal laws that seem to be an impediment to the states passing their own legislation.
Okay. So let's say either you know, we get a favorable decision from the Supreme Court or Congress acts. What is the process at that point when sports betting is open to the state, not necessarily become legal all across the nation, but each state will have an opportunity to decide on for themselves?
Well, assuming that the decision allows for the states to decide for themselves, unfortunately, I think it's going to be a real hodgepodge.
Yeah.
Because each state is going to be subjected to the local vicissitudes of lobbying their government, their constitution, any applicable Indian compacts.
Sure, right.
And so I think we're going to get a real hodgepodge of experiments.
Mm-hmm. And what role do you think the leagues are playing? I mean, we'll get to this 1% integrity fee in a second, but do you think that they're going to be able to pressure these state legislators because, you know, they may have a professional team in their state or something like that?
Well, they certainly have deep pockets, and we're certainly seeing that there is that pressure being exerted.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, they want a piece of the action,
sure,
and we know that.
Right.
And so And there's a case from 25 years ago, the Motorola case, a Supreme Court case, okay. that basically stands for the proposition that the leagues can't charge royalties for that game content. Mm-hmm. It's not their intellectual property.
Right.
So now they're looking for another angle to monetize it. So mm-hmm. I think they're clearly we're seeing there's going to be a lot of pressure exerted by the leagues to get a piece of the action.
Okay. So we've got a state we're sitting in that,
right.
that has had legal sports betting for decades, and it's been successful. Why don't other states just copy what we have here in Nevada?
They should.
Of course. That would make it easier.
They should. But you know, fortunately, we don't need new legislation here.
Right.
So we don't need to deal with the political pressures and the you know crazy fundraising and the lobbying efforts and all of that. And I think that states should definitely copy a successful model if mm-hmm. they can.
Right.
But again, they've got all sorts of pressures that Nevada isn't under because we passed our laws long before all of
right,
this nonsense.
Right. Well, explain the margins of sports betting. A lot of people think it's just an endless pot of money, but it's not.
It's remarkable, the misunderstanding of that. When I see some of the speculation about numbers, mm-hmm. there are two things that I think are going on. One, there's a focus on handle.
Right.
Which is, of course, the amount of money being bet, mm-hmm. not on anybody's profit margin.
Right.
And so throwing around $400 billion, boy, that sounds like a lucrative business.
Right.
And I think the other thing is when I hear speculation about profit margin, if you reverse engineer the numbers, it looks as though the assumptions are we're like Australia or
right.
something, which
yeah.
has a 10 to 12% hold mm-hmm. with their sports books.
Right.
We don't. The best-run sportsbook in Nevada has about a 4.6 to 4.8%
mm-hmm.
hold.
Right.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a slim margin business. It is an amenity for casino customers. Mm-hmm. It is not a cash cow
right.
if done well.
And it's also a skill game for the players because the knowledgeable sports bettors, you know, can often, you know, be consistent winners.
Absolutely right. The sharps, as
right.
we call them,
mm-hmm.
Statistically do a lot better than the average player,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, reduces
right.
the profit margin for the casinos. I mean, let's look at the NFL championship game.
Right.
In Nevada, it was 0.7%, I think, was the hold.
Right, yes.
a huge money opportunity.
Right. So you mentioned the big number. Do you think that the proponents of the legalization of sports betting made a mistake by quoting these huge numbers? I mean, like you said, it's a real misconception when you see these numbers out there. And certainly they're true. They're a handle. But when you talk about what we just talked about, the percentage that you hold on that is minuscule. So was it a mistake to really put those numbers out there?
Well, it depends on to whom you're speaking, I
right.
suppose. I mean, I think those numbers are great propaganda for the leagues,
right.
saying we just want a little tiny piece
sure.
of this giant
right.
market.
Only 1%
of this giant market. But I think it has led to a really big public misunderstanding
mm-hmm.
of how big this would get.
Right.
In states that aren't like Nevada, that don't have these giant resort hotels that offer all sorts of things to the customer besides a sports book.
Right, okay. Well, let's talk about the integrity fee. They're talking integrity in quotes, I would
right.
put it, because it's actually opposite that. But let's talk about you know what the leagues want. It's 1% of this big number. And
right.
it doesn't sound, well, only 1%, but how does that impact the profitability of a sports book?
I joke. It's the fee that would murder legal sports betting in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't work.
Right.
Because it's a 1% fee.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get rid of the integrity part for,
right.
for a minute, if you
exactly.
can see my raised eyebrow.
Sure.
it's a 1% fee on handle. So
right.
not on profit, not on win, a top line integrity fee. It's a tax.
Right.
And basically, when I think if you go do a little history lesson in Nevada,
mm-hmm.
we have a federal wagering excise tax,
right.
which is 0.25%.
Mm-hmm.
And when that tax was 2%,
right.
all the sports books closed in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it doesn't work.
Right.
Once you impose that kind of fee on handle, it becomes an economically unviable business model,
right.
period.
Yeah.
So it would murder regulated sports betting.
Mm-hmm. Even before it got started.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but the reason I put integrity in quotes is because doesn't that actually do the opposite? I mean, when the leagues are dependent upon, you know, how much handle is out there, that they make decisions that would encourage more betting. And how would you know that they made that decision? I mean, it just really threatens the integrity of the games rather than props it up.
I think you're exactly right. I think that if the leagues are in the business of driving handle, you could create some really perverse incentives, strange behavior. Heck, we could change the rules of football so you have to kick that extra point.
Right, right.
I think it could create some really, really perverse behavior.
Yeah, no question about that. Now, the league supposedly already have systems in place that are able to detect irregularities in betting or irregularities in statistics and things of that nature. There are companies, obviously, that provide that information. Why do they need an integrity fee then if they've already got they're already covering that?
They don't. No, they just have to come up with a politically palatable, good sounding way of describing just taking a piece of the action like any bookmaker. Mm-hmm. As you said, it's already really an efficient market.
Right.
I mean, in Nevada, it works just fine. Mm-hmm. We don't need the league's help.
Right.
The good longtime bookmakers in the regulated markets are the ones that have always been the first to spot anomalous betting patterns.
Right.
They were the ones who identified the point shaving. Mm-hmm. Again, if we go to the history lesson, it's the bookmakers that have always done that.
Right.
We don't need any help.
Yeah. So let's talk about illegal sports betting now, because this is obviously what the goal is, to try to eliminate illegal sports betting. If you add the integrity fee on, it's not going to eliminate that. If you make it difficult for the legal bookmakers to make money, you know, the illegal bookmakers are going to offer a better deal. Like if you have to change the odds from 11 to 10 to 12 to 10 or something of that nature, the illegal bookmakers are still going to have an edge on you. So what kind of illegal what does illegal sports betting do to governments today?
Well, what we have right now is a huge, huge illegal sports betting market. Mm-hmm. You hear estimates from $170 to $400 billion.
Right.
I mean, by any estimate, Nevada is shy of $5 billion, so maybe 1% of the illegal market.
Right.
I mean, it's a staggering statistic. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, you have this giant illegal unregulated market. We're not collecting the tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's state or national,
right.
We're not getting the suspicious activity transaction reporting that would be required if you were in the regulated arena. So there's probably all sorts of criminal activity going on in terms of things like money laundering and so forth. And so you're right. If we're going to legalize and regulate sports betting, we need to create a model that will at least shrink that illegal market.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make it a model that's not economically viable, that's too clunky and cumbersome and intrusive for the players and difficult, why would anybody shift from the illegal market to the legal market?
Right. And it's very easy to bet on the illegal market. And, you know, online you can go to, you know, we all know Pinnacle Sports, and
sure,
it's totally illegal in this country, but they've got millions of customers. So, you know, why would somebody shift something that they're comfortable with into something that may be a little more costly, and even though it's legal?
That's right. I think the things that would potentially get those customers over there is the assurance that their money is going to be safe, that their accounts would be secure, that they would be able to get their money out.
Right.
And so certainly I could see a scenario where with the opening up of the legal sports betting market, our law enforcement should probably get more involved in making some examples of the illegal sports betting operators to shut them down.
Sure.
So maybe there's a real chilling effect that sends people over to the legal market.
Mm-hmm.
That would seem logical.
That would be, and that would certainly be one of the results of this, and hopefully we'd use some of the tax revenue to do that.
But yes.
We never know. So let's talk about some of the specifics. You did mention the federal excise taxes. Is that an impediment if it goes up, or is it okay the way it is now, do you think?
It seems as though it's okay the way it is now.
Yeah.
It's been at 0.25% of legal wagers for a long time. I don't remember off the top of my head for how long, but when it dropped to that 0.25%, the sports books reopened in Las Vegas. Right. There aren't many standalone because, again, it's such a slim margin business.
Sure,
But at 0.25%, it makes it viable. But if we add any of those other handle taxes, like the integrity fee, or we raise the federal tax rate, the excise tax, then we're going to have an economic viability problem.
Right. Okay. So another issue is the Wire Act. You know, in 2011, when the DOJ issued their memorandum that kind of legalized iGaming, in states that want to legalize it, it specifically said no sports betting across state lines. So that is definitely in place, and that's going to be an impediment to profitability as well.
Absolutely, and it's amazing. A few years ago, nobody had heard of PASPA.
Right.
And now everybody's talking about PASPA, and very few people are talking about the Wire Act.
Right.
Because the Wire Act would, of course, prohibit sports bets from going across state lines.
Right.
So any sportsbook operator could only be taking bets from within the state that is located.
Right.
And so the Wire Act is a huge impediment to this market.
So is there going to be an effort, do you think, by the states and Congress to amend that or even get rid of it?
Maybe. Maybe not.
Yeah.
Because the interesting thing about the Wire Act is there's a safe harbor in there for information assisting in the placement of bets or wagers.
Yeah.
So if you are transmitting information assisting the placement of bets or wagers across state lines from a jurisdiction where it's legal to another jurisdiction where it's legal, that's okay under the Wire Act. So I could see some of the larger sportsbook operators being very interested in keeping the Wire Act the way it is, because they're in a position, if they're operating in multiple jurisdictions, to do some global risk management in sharing information, so that if they're heavy in one jurisdiction, they can offset in another jurisdiction in terms of their betting. So there are a lot of parties that might be interested in keeping the Wire Act the way it is.
Okay. And that would also, however, limit the size of the market in any particular state.
Absolutely right. Yeah. You have a potentially the liquidity problem, just as though, just like when we had internet poker, we joked about when Delaware signed on, well, great, we have another nine people who can participate in poker.
Right. And, New Jersey's done very well with their iGaming, but they're pretty much tapped out now. They need to do interstate compacts, and I know that's in discussion with them, but if they get sports betting, they're gonna hit the ceiling pretty quickly.
Absolutely. That's what happens.
Yeah.
So we might need to do something about the Wire Act.
Great. So what do casinos have to do to prepare for this possible legalization of sports betting? What are some of the steps they have to take?
Well, I think there are a few things. I mean, I think they're the practical steps. Mm-hmm. Do they want to physically accommodate having a racing sports book?
Right.
It's a really big footprint. Mm-hmm. Is it something that is very attractive to their customer base?
Right.
Does it serve their demographic? Will they be able to offer it via app on their phone?
Right.
I mean, the brick-and-mortar customer is dwindling.
Right.
I personally have a sports betting app, and I won't mention the name of the bookmaker. Right? And I do it from the comfort of my couch.
Right.
And I'm not even a millennial.
Right.
So I think understanding your market, understanding whether the footprint of your casino makes sense, obviously making sure that the law makes this something that is economically viable for you, and figuring out the partners. Are you going to use a third-party bookmaker because you have no experience doing it yourself?
Right.
That is figuring out your relationships, where you're getting the data, who's going to run your book, getting those things kind of set up.
Right. Yeah, and as you mentioned, it's difficult to run it on your own. You have to have a lot of expertise in-house, and it's such a small margin anyway. So, here in Nevada, there's very few independent casinos that run their own book.
They
can bring in William Hill or Canner Gaming or CG Technologies now or one of the others. The large chains they have an in-house things, but they have a lot of casinos. So do you think the other casinos in the country are going to have to consider those type of arrangements?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think they'd be crazy not to.
Right.
Bring in somebody that knows what they're doing and who can do that global risk management I mentioned.
Right.
So they're not as constrained by having only a tiny marketplace of information that they can use.
Right.
So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, sure. And, we just got back from London, went to the ICE show, and probably, 30% of their floor is occupied by companies that have sports betting products, either with either service or information or something like that. So How are those companies going to play into an expanded industry in this country?
Well, I think they're trying really, really hard.
Right.
I think some of the larger ones seem to be lobbying for laws that provide you must use our service to get game information. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty scary, pretty anti-competitive.
Right.
So that I'd like to think those kinds of lobbying efforts won't work. I think the other thing that they can do is really to get a jump start, I would say get your product approved here.
Mm-hmm.
Get it reviewed by GLI, for example, using Nevada standards.
Mm-hmm.
If it's something that would require individual licensing, like you have a cashless wagering system or that kind of thing, get found suitable. Get a jump on everybody else. And probably if you adhere to Nevada standards, you'd likely be very, very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But there are only a few players that provide this information.
Yeah.
There are very, very few.
In this country.
Yes.
That are licensed right now.
There are, I can think of maybe three in Nevada.
Right.
So it's an uphill climb.
Right. But at the same time, there is a little reluctance from them, from the European companies to come to this country because the regulations are a little more stringent here than they are in European circles. So what would you say to those companies, you know, who would say, well, we're not going to go through that kind of scrutiny? Do you agree with that, or do you think they're overstating the problems that they'll face here?
I think they're overstating the problems that they'll face here.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been plenty of foreign companies that have been found suitable in Nevada.
Right.
And so the idea is, it's on the one hand, it's intrusive and a difficult process because we want to ensure integrity in the system. Let's go back to integrity.
Right.
That's actual integrity.
Yes.
And so that the public, it isn't only objectively fair, but the public perceives it as fair.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, once you've come through the other side of that, you've gotten the stamp of approval in terms of the quality of your operations, the quality of the individuals involved, and you've just thrown up a huge barrier to entry for the people that don't want to bother going through the process.
Right.
So I would say make your cost-benefit analysis.
Sure.
Is it worth it to you?
Right.
Then do it.
Right. And would you suggest Nevada being the starting point?
Of course. Of course.
Just because we're sitting here?
Partly because we're sitting here, but of course we know what we're doing.
Right.
And we've been doing it longer than any other state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, very professional regulatory process.
Mm-hmm.
We have professional investigators. We have very progressive regulators.
Right.
There's no hostility towards new products or any of that. On the contrary, it's always about bringing in new products and being in the vanguard of what's going on in the United States. So there are a lot of reasons why Nevada makes sense.
Right, no question. So let's wrap it up with what you see happening within the next year or so, you know, one way or the other with the court case.
Yes, I think there's a good shot that the actual decision in the Christie 2 case is perhaps incoherent.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a splitting of the baby that's going to go on.
Right.
Because, of course, I don't think the United States Supreme Court cares about sports betting.
Right.
I think they care about commandeering principles, preemption. So I think the decision in the case is going to be bright lines about constitutional relationships, not about sports betting.
Right.
So I think that might drive Congress to perhaps just repeal PASPA, this very strange law.
Right.
And then I think the states will experiment, subject to the constraints that we've talked about. I think the world has changed. Well, I think the United States has changed when it comes to sports betting.
You mentioned the constitutional principles. You know, people forget that the court doesn't hear things just because it's a sports betting issue. They hear it because it's a constitutional issue, and this case actually has a lot of repercussions in the legal marijuana business and things of that nature too. So it goes beyond just sports betting.
Absolutely right. I could see definitely application to marijuana legalization. Potentially civil rights issues, gun ownership issues.
Right.
I mean, it's really, the case is about the tension between the federal government and state governments.
Right.
It's a 10th Amendment case.
Right.
So if you're a constitutional nerd, it's super interesting.
Right.
It has very little to do with sports betting.
Right. Okay, thanks for joining us. Loved hearing your expertise, and I'm sure we'll get more of that in our magazine in the few months leading up to this. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us on the GGB Podcast, sponsored by Southern Gaming Summit, May 2nd and 3rd in Biloxi, Mississippi. If you want to learn more about any of the information offered today, visit ggbmagazine.com. For weekly news of the gaming industry, visit ggbnews.com. And for news of the Indian gaming industry, visit tribalgovernmentgaming.com. Follow us on Twitter at Global Gaming Biz or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Global Gaming Business. We'll see you next week on the GGB Podcast.